I would like to thank Harry Thomason and all the people who made this film possible, and Joe Connison and Gene Lyons, who wrote the book. They did a fine job. There are several people out here in the audience who were on the receiving end of Mr. Starr's tender mercies. But the star of the movie and my heroine through this whole thing was Susan McDougal. Where are you? Stand up. Where are you? There she is. Where is she? Thank you. Thank you. If you like what's in the film about her, wait till you read about what I wrote in the book. Harry Evans is going to come out here and ask me two or three questions about this, but I wanted to say a couple of things to try to put this film into some historical context for you. Because you either have to believe one of two things. There's one possible explanation for all this, you know, and that's the story of my favorite joke. The guy's walking along the Grand Canyon, enjoying the sights, and he just slips, and he's falling to certain death. And he sees a little twig coming out of the rock, and he grabs it, and it breaks his fall. And just as he begins to heave a sigh of relief, the roots start coming out. And he realizes it's over, and he looks in the sky, and he says, "God, why me? I am a good man. I have worked hard all my life. I have paid my taxes. I have raised my children. Why me?" And this thunderous voice says, "Son, there's just something about you I don't like." Now, that is, of course, one possible explanation for what you have just seen. The other one has larger historical roots. Mr. Starr and his operation, and Mr. Ewing, they were not just independent renegades. They were the instruments of a grand design. And Mr. Starr just did what he was hired to do. That's why Robert Fisk, who was a professional Republican prosecutor, was replaced. He was too fast and too fair. He had to go. And I think it's important that you understand that. The roots of this and the rise of the right in America basically began in the 1960s. And all the turmoil of the 60s over civil rights and the war, aggravated by the women's movement and the gay rights movement and the controversy over Roe v. Wade. And then when the Berlin Wall fell, the perpetual right in America, which always needs an enemy, didn't have an enemy anymore. So I had to serve as the next best thing. I think it's really important that you understand that. In the mid to late 70s, most of the white Southerners who were anti-civil rights had migrated by then to the Republican Party. And there was this militant anti-government movement, which was personified by the Proposition 78 movement out in California. And the man who led that, Grover Norquist, now convenes a weekly meeting of these conservative groups every week in Washington, D.C. to plot strategy. Then the religious right came up in the 70s as a potent political force, and they all got married. And they thought they had found a permanent way of holding the White House, to characterize the Democrats as weak elitists who couldn't be trusted with your tax money, couldn't be trusted to defend your country, couldn't be trusted to provide safe streets, didn't believe in work, wanted to give all your money to poor people, most of whom were people of color. And they thought they had this formula that would always work. And it worked, and we helped them, frankly. Our party, we made a lot of mistakes, and we didn't modernize. We didn't do a lot of the things that we should have done. They considered President Carter's victory in 1976 an aberrational result of Watergate that they felt would literally never occur again, as long as they kept putting us in the cookie cutter. So when it didn't work in 92, they thought that the natural order of things had been interrupted. And I think it's very important that you understand that, because most of you are here because you agree with us. But you have to understand there is an honest disagreement in America today, in the aftermath of the Cold War, in a globally interdependent world, as we move from an industrial age into a global information age economy where the kind of way government operated before is not entirely relevant to the present and has to be changed. So the anti-government values crowd basically believes that the most important thing to do is to make sure the right people are in power and then to concentrate power and wealth in their hands. That's what they honestly believe. They don't think they're bad people. And I think it's a mistake for us to treat them the way they treated us. Because if we do that, then they own us. They basically turned us into the kind of Pavlovian creatures that they try to make their voters be. If they get to, I think it's important that we not respond in kind, but instead to argue and fight on a different ground. You can see the import of this was to convince the American people that I was a bad person. Susan McDougal was a bad person. Everybody else that was in the way was a bad person. I don't think we have to say they're bad people. We have to say that we think we're right and they're wrong, and here's why. It's a very different argument. But it's a distinction that I think is of profound importance. I got to be careful what I say now, because I'm not supposed to talk about much in my book until my book comes out. But I told this story at the booksellers, so I can tell it again. I had a science teacher when I was 13 years old who gave a little talk one day. It was the only thing I remember from science. And he was, to put it charitably, not a handsome man, my science teacher. He had a beautiful wife who taught me history, a beautiful sister-in-law who taught me geography. He was a retired coach who was thick-bodied, wore Coke bottle glasses, smoked cheap cigars in a cigar holder that he held in his mouth and pinched, and he had a big old hawk nose, and he knew it. So here's the story he told. He said, I want you to remember something, kids. You won't remember anything about science, but I want you to remember this. And 45 years later, I still do. He said, every morning I get up and I go into the bathroom and I put water on my face and I put my shaving cream on and I shave and then I wipe the cream off and I look in that mirror and I say, Vernon, you're beautiful. He said, you need to remember that. Everybody wants to believe they're beautiful. And if you remember that, it'll save you a lot of trouble in life and take you a long way. I don't think we should get into that kind of demonization. But I believe that the evidence shows, I mean, we tried it their way for almost 16 years, and we tried it our way for 8 years. I think the evidence shows our way works better. And I think that and I had one of those guys tell me, he was kind of a good friend of mine, he said, you know, I hate the way we treat you, but if we fought you fair, you'd beat us every time, so we got to convince people you're no good. That's the only way we can win. If we just demonize you, convince people you're no good, then we don't have to argue about whether your economic policies, your social policies, your foreign policies are right or wrong. We'll just say you're no good. And if you believe that you're right and your side is good and you have good values and the other side has bad values, then you can see how naturally it flows from that your number one value would be to have your crowd in and to concentrate power and wealth in their hands. And it leads you to a whole range of things. You know, I can say this now because I never had any money until I left the White House, and they were pretty mean to me for a while, and all of a sudden I became the most important person in the world to them once I got a little money. I mean, you know, to protect my tax cut this year, we kicked 300,000 poor kids out of their after-school programs. I'd rather fight about that, wouldn't you? I'm just saying. And we could go through all these other things, but I want you to understand that from their point of view, they made us all sort of almost non-persons. Susan McDougal was an expendable casualty of war. There were a lot of others too, people that Harriet and the filmmakers didn't have time to write about. And I tried to talk about them. And Joe and Gene talked about them in the book. What they did to people you never heard of and that were never reported on. And it was crazy. And you should stand against it. But you should stand against it not by responding in kind, but by exposing what was going on here. And, you know, I think the only other thing I want to say is Hillary once was hooted and derided when she called it a vast right-wing conspiracy. And, you know, the only thing that I said when she came home and asked me what I thought about it, I said, well, the only thing I don't know is about that conspiracy word. Conspiracies are normally secret. This is wide out in the open. It's just that they're covering it up. And it's pretty self-evident what the facts were. But we are, now let me just say one other thing about the historical context, and then I'll ask Harry to come on, we'll ask the questions. You were living in a period, which you should be glad of, in spite of all the troubles with it, a vast sweeping change in the way we work and live and relate to each other and the rest of the world. At every hinge point in American history, we have a fight like we're having now. Our founders gave us a mission. Remember what they said our mission was? Our mission, they pledged their lives, their fortunes, their sacred honor to form a more perfect union. Now, that was both a humble statement and a bold statement. It was humble because they recognized that as flawed human beings, we will never be perfect. And as long as people are on the face of the earth, there will be problems. It was bold because it embodied the 18th century idea of progress. It could always be more perfect. So most of us who are Democrats and a lot of people who were part of the traditional Republican Party were sort of communitarian. They thought that we should work together because we could always do more together than we could apart, and we could always be more perfect. And whatever came along, whatever circumstances changed, whatever challenges presented themselves, whatever opportunities were there, we could become more perfect. But that requires us to believe in evidence over ideology, to test our ideas and our convictions against circumstances and to measure them based on whether real people's lives are better or worse after we do whatever we say we want to do. But we always fight about this. At big times of change, they require us to define, defend, and expand the union. Now, I'll just give you a couple of examples. The personal animosity which I engendered, maybe because there's just something about me they didn't like, and the kind of intensity, and by the way, the legalization of politics, putting everybody through the courts and all that, the time that most paralleled that in the history of our country was the beginning of the Republic. Because about all the American people agreed on was we didn't want to live under England's thumb anymore and we wanted George Washington to be our first leader. That was it. And in Washington's second term, everybody realized he was on the way out the door and nobody had really defined what it meant to be an American. The two big questions were we going to have a national economy, or were we going to have a national legal system? And they brutalized each other. The Washington and his crowd and John Adams and Alexander Hamilton and John Marshall and his crowd until we worked it out. Then we had 40 years of stability. Then we fought for another 25 years or more about the Union. Were we if you got into the Union, could you get out if you didn't like what they were doing on slavery? If you join any other club, you can get out of it. I said it like that because it's self-evident now that Lincoln was right, but it wasn't at the time. What are we going to do about slavery? And if you join the Union, can you turn around and get out? From 1840 all through the Civil War, through Abraham Lincoln's death and Andrew Johnson's impeachment in a fight about what the Reconstruction would look like, we fought about it. It wasn't really resolved until Ulysses Grant was elected president in 1868. Then we had total calm for several decades. Then we became an industrial nation, not an agricultural nation. The cities exploded. New York got a whole new wave of immigrants from all across the world we never had before. And the question was, can you be a great industrial power with all these monopolistic entities like Standard Oil, unless you also have a great governmental power to ensure competition, protect natural resources from depletion, and ensure decency in the workplace and social justice? Theodore Roosevelt said, no, you can't. You got to have those things. When he left office, William Howard Taft said, nah, we're not for big government. That's how the Democrats became the Progressive Party in America. Woodrow Wilson got elected and took up the mantle that had belonged to the Republicans from Abraham Lincoln through Theodore Roosevelt. And for nearly a century, we've been the Progressive Party. But the role of government in the industrial age was arguably not resolved until the end of World War II. Because as soon as Wilson left office, we had 12 years of reaction, we had a depression, we had the Second World War. But at the end of World War II, we had pretty well solidified through Roosevelt's reforms and Truman's decision to go on with the United Nations, the fact that America had to be involved in the world and we needed a government to protect competition, protect our natural resources, and protect decency in the workplace and promote social justice. And we rocked along for a while until, for another several decades, until it was obvious that the Cold War was ending and that we had changed our economy again. We were in a global information age, so we had to have this fight all over again. And we had more diversity than ever before. When Hillary and I went to a grade school that had to be moved after 9/11, there were 600 kids in that school, and they came from over 80 different nations. So by then, you know, we've weathered a civil rights revolution, we've been through the women's rights revolution, and now we're dealing with how we're going to deal with this unprecedented religious, racial diversity, the whole gay rights issue, and what should be the what is the role of government in the post-industrial era? And what does it mean in this age to define, defend, and expand the union? Now, the people on the far right have their view, and they're pursuing it as they think they should. We can win that fight because if you look back in American history, every time we've had this fight, we have always decided to expand and defend the union, our community. What does that mean? It means widening the circle of opportunity, deepening the meaning of freedom, and broadening the reach of community. That's what it means. It's what it's always meant. You go back to the beginning of the country. So I think you should feel optimistic. And you should be very grateful that, at least I am, that the American people, every time they get a clear shot and see what's really going on, they go forward. Now, you should also be, those of you that share my politics, you should be realistic about this. When I left office, about two-thirds of the people supported the general direction we had taken. The election of 2000 was 50-50 in part because they're much more closely divided if you can make the case, should we cut taxes or not, instead of what are the consequences of a tax cut. And they're much more divided on the cultural issues. As my Democrat friends from Oklahoma say, God, gays, and guns. And choice. So they're much more closely divided. And these kinds of things that this movie chronicles will abate as we move to a new consensus about what it means to be an American in the 21st century world. And you can't afford to let us make the wrong decision. Because the central insight of the framers of the Constitution was that a democracy is about not just majority rule, but about minority rights. It's about striking the balance between empowering the government to do what people need to do for themselves together, while absolutely preventing the kind of abuse of power chronicled in this film. That's really what this is about. Susan McDougall was a victim of abuse of power. She was simply a political pawn. And the unconscionable thing is that it went on for a long time, and the people who were supposed to prevent abuse of power said or did nothing about it. And there were many, many more like her. But now we got a belly full of that, and we know better. And so now we have to fight over the real issues. So I wanted to say that to you so you would understand. I don't wake up in the morning hating Ken Starr. I wake up in the morning feeling sorry for people who believe that they are in possession of the whole truth and that that justifies their trampling other people. And I think you should too. I don't think, as a Christian, I don't think a reasonable reading of the scriptures supports that conclusion and supports that sort of political program. Although I think the framers were right that we should separate religion from politics. And one of the reasons America's most religious country in the world is that we haven't tried to have our politics driven by religion. So, for whatever it's worth, that's the historical context of this film. And that's why this film is so important. Another hero in this story that's not chronicled in this is my first legal counsel, Bernie Nussbaum, out there, who begged me not to ask for an independent counsel. One thing that is not said here, everybody's forgotten this, there was no independent counsel law when I asked for an independent counsel in Whitewater. We were just getting killed. The New York Times wanted one, the Washington Post wanted one. The Washington Post says, of course there's no legal basis for this in their editorial. That under the old law or the new law, there never would have been one appointed, but we'd like to have one anyway, because these people are asking a lot of questions, and so what difference does it make if you've got an untrammeled counsel? And I was such a naive fool, I thought people actually wanted to know the truth. And I knew I hadn't done anything wrong. I lost money in a land deal. And the guy I lost money with later went into the S&L business, and I never borrowed any money from him. And Hillary's law firm did a grand total of 21 hours of legal business for him, and they turned that into a $70 million deal. Can you get that? So there's lots of responsibility to go around here. That doesn't exonerate me from the stupid personal and wrong personal mistakes I made, but all this started because I actually believed when the press was saying they wanted to know the truth about what went on, that they actually wanted to know the truth. And in 1996, another Republican inquiry headed by Jay Stevens, who was a U.S. attorney that I replaced in D.C. for the Resolution Trust Corporation, issued a comprehensive report saying that neither Hillary or I had done anything wrong in Whitewater. Not criminally wrong, not civilly wrong. And furthermore, that these billing records that they made such a big to-do over actually confirmed her accounts. And I'll bet you there aren't 5% of the people in this audience that knew we had been exonerated by a former Republican United States attorney in a government report in 1996. Why? You didn't know that, did you? No, it was covered up by a lot of these people taking pictures of us here. Why? But it was covered up. Now, before Gene Lyons was impudent enough to write a book on this, which was widely dismissed in the establishment press because they couldn't quarrel with any of the factual assertions in the book, so they just dismissed it. He actually used to write stories for the New York Times. But, you know, he went against the conventional wisdom. The mainstream press basically was in the tank with Starr, by and large, until the issuance of the Starr report. And I give them this, there was a dramatic sea change then. Until the 1990 election, the issue of the Starr report, after that, the press coverage was balanced. And you will never hear me criticize or complain about the press coverage I got in the aftermath of all the stuff that happened in 98 and my deposition in the Jones case. I'm talking about what happened before, for years and years and years, that led to the crushing of these innocent people. And it's because those guys figured out that what really mattered was having a scandal. We thought we were in a bubble where politics didn't matter and nobody had to take the work that the presidency did, the work that the Congress did, and take it seriously. But it does matter. And since 9/11, we all know it matters again, don't we? It matters. It matters. This is, the presidency is a choosing job. And the people who work in the White House have to make lots of choices. And now we're in a period of change when the choices are different and honestly and deeply held. So I made a mistake too, because I asked for the fool thing. And Bernie Nussbaum's my hero because he begged me not to do it. He said, this is an evil institution. Do not do this. And I said, well, Janet Reno will appoint a reasonable Republican. I know she'll appoint a Republican, but I don't care. I didn't do anything. What are they going to do? And soon as Robert Fisk said Vince Foster killed himself, which was hardly a revolution, they ran him out on a rail and they put in somebody that was more result-oriented, shall we say. And I actually thought the whole thing was legit, you know, when I started. But, you know, I just, what am I? I'm just some guy from Arkansas. I thought the law was a law, you know. So I was responsible, too. I was completely, I missed that. But the framers of our Constitution expected people to abuse their power if there were not limits on it. That's why they put limits on it. That's why they were so smart, and that's one reason we're still around here after over 200 years. So the independent counsel law is gone. The philosophical differences between the two approaches to the 21st century remain. The reason the last election was 50-50 is we hadn't decided which way we're going yet. And the country is still fairly evenly divided, as you see from the current surveys. So I hope that what you will glean from this movie, besides being profoundly moved by the courage of Susan and many other people and profoundly repulsed by the kind of abuse of power and the crushing of the innocents involved, is that you need to take sides because we're not finished our last big job of forming a more perfect union. Thank you very much. Harry?
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. All the people who are clapping, we want a 4,000 word essay on the American presidency on his desk in the morning. And Mr. President, thank you for the eloquent insight into history and the walk through contemporary problems. We all of us felt for Susan McDougall when she was asked to make up a story. Don't worry about that, they'll give you one. What was it? How did you sustain yourself in this ordeal? You knew what kind of people there were in Arkansas. You knew what was being said. How did you keep yourself sane?
Well, some would argue I didn't. I tell you what, most days it bothered me more what was happening to other people. For one thing, like I said, I believed it was a legit deal, so I almost blamed myself for being stupid enough to ask for the thing in the first place. And Bernie said on the phone that night, we discussed it, I was in Russia, it was a week after my mother died, he said, they're going to pass this independent counsel law, you're going to sign it. Chief Justice Rehnquist gets to decide who gets to name the judges on the D.C. Court of Appeals, and Janet will appoint somebody moderate, and then they'll get rid of them. And a lot of the young people on my staff were just ridiculing Bernie, saying, how can you be so paranoid? How can you believe anything so absurd could happen? And finally, I knew I hadn't done anything wrong. I knew Hillary hadn't done anything wrong. I got tired of fooling with it. So I said to myself, I am not going to compound my error by giving in to the suckers. That's part of it. And part of it was my friends stayed with me. And even after I committed a horrible mistake, my administration stayed, my friends stayed, and the American people stayed. That made it a lot easier. And I also, I kept thinking about all the little people that had been hurt, and I just decided, if I give into this, I will compound my error. I'm not going to double my mistake by letting the wrong people win. It's not very complicated. That's basically what I thought. And so when I realized that there was no limit to what they could do, there was nothing to do but just sort of suit up and take the field. That's what I did.
You're kind of optimistic. I got how you sustain yourself.
You got to be.
I think most of us seeing that film felt a sense of outrage. And you gave the kind of impression in your remarks just now that maybe things have changed enough that it couldn't happen again, that the institutions of the United States are now in a stronger position to resist this kind of, that kind of politics of good and evil.
Unless people with the same philosophy control all branches of government. You know, in my book, I talk a lot about other court decisions that none of you know anything about, other judicial decisions. I think that's something you got to be sensitive to. I mean, that it's very important. The thing that I hope that this movie will do is to show people that, again, I say, look, I had to go. You can be outraged if you want to, but if I was outraged all this time after I've been outraged for years before, I'd be a dead man now. Sooner or later, you got to let it go. And if you want to be forgiven, you have to extend forgiveness, even for people who aren't smart enough to ask for it. You just got to do that. I mean, you got to do it. It's just, you got to let it go. But I want you to be outraged by the abuse of power. I just want you to understand that Kenneth Starr was not an independent actor. That's what I want to say. Nor did he see himself as a power abuser. He saw himself as throwing the infidels from the temple and being part of this big movement to do that. And you can't whip somebody you're on opposite sides with unless you understand how they see the world and what they are. That's the only point I was trying to make.
Well, you made it very well. How can we strengthen the institutions, particularly the press? The press is getting more concentrated. The New York Times has just apologized for getting us into the Iraq War. How can we...
Let me just say this. Let me say something for the New York Times, because I bashed them. I don't like the way... They didn't get Whitewater right. They got it all wrong in the beginning. But the New York Times was the first great establishment institution that got it wrong to at least have a conscience. They did finally say that Kenneth Starr should resign when he was making money from the tobacco companies as they were fighting me when I was trying to stop teen smoking while he was persecuting me. And as he was making money from a conservative foundation taking a position against an education issue that I had taken. And you know, they ignored his early conflicts, but they did at least say that. And after I don't think that's it. I think you need to worry more about the concentration of this right-wing view of government, particularly in the courts. The Congress is pretty much evenly divided now. And even if we win both houses in the next election, our side does, it'll still be sort of evenly divided. That is, we may swap a small, narrow minority for a narrow majority status. And we got a 50-50 chance, maybe a little better, than win the White House next time. But you have to worry. You have to worry when the political process also operates on both Republicans and Democrats if they're elected officials. What you really have to worry is putting all these ultra-right-wing ideologues on the courts and giving them lifetime jobs and then letting them make consequence-free decisions. That's what you really have to worry about.
Okay.
You get one more question, don't
okay,
you? Okay. I want to go see my friends. They're getting bored. Look, half the crowd's already left.
You could stay here forever. It's fine. We'd like this to go on all night, I'm sure. The real central thing, though, you really still haven't answered, which is, it's okay, I take the message about we got to watch who gets elected, we're all going to vote, so on, so on, so on. But if our information and opinions are coming through a press which is more and more concentrated, where the standards of journalism, frankly, are not what they used to be, and I spent 40 years in journalism, so I think I can say it with certain authority, what can we do about that, the conduit of misinformation?
No, we are doing it, but let me just say this. You have to have competition there, but you have to find it in new and different ways. I mean, look at what MoveOn.org did this year. Look at what Air America is doing. I mean, Al Franken is beating Rush Limbaugh in a couple of markets in America already with that little tiny network. So I think Look, when you're up against something, you can either sit around and whine about it, or you can do something about it. I believe one of the things that happened, and I've talked to enough of my friends in the media to know this now, that is that, you know, I just sort of thought the whole thing was legit and would play itself out. Underneath that, I now know that all the networks were just being fed garbage constantly, and there wasn't a countervailing pressure. All we did was kind of answer the public questions, you know? And it's a pretty juicy deal if you think. What happened to the establishment media is, briefly, they forgot what they did in Watergate. What they did in Watergate was to prevent an abuse of power. And it made them all the heroes of America. And they, looking back on it, thought that the game was get the president, not stop abuse of power. So they wound up being the handmaidens of this abuse of power. They got over it. By and large, the press corrected itself once the Starr report was issued, and there were several hundred references to sex and two to Whitewater. And when they realized they were going to go forward with impeachement, notwithstanding the fact that we had won seats in the House of Representatives, first time a president's party had done that since in the 6 year of a presidency since 1822 in 1998. Then things got corrected a little bit in the press. We need to give our opponents their due. They very often are better organized, more aggressive, and more effective than we are. So now this year,